I think there is a huge difference between studying and working professionally. What you have a chance to do when you're studying is to spend a lot more time on examining things and analyzing things and developing things. When we work professionally, we are always under pressure.
Welcome to the newest episode of Herbcast. And this episode will be special, and not only because of the guest, but because this is the first episode of the series that I'm creating for you. The series is called Landscape Architecture Series, and in this one, we will be exploring landscape architecture with leading professionals within the field. I will be talking to renowned landscape architects, most of them based in Copenhagen or Denmark, but not only. And we will discuss this Danish approach, or just successful approach, to designing landscape architecture and our public spaces in many different cities. We reached out to several inspiring landscape architects, and Jakob, my today's guest, will be the first of them to talk about landscape architecture from many different perspectives. Today, in this one, we will be talking about sustainability and innovation, but also the intersection between those with business. So how to talk to clients about landscape architecture, and how to share and inspire the clients to invest maybe more money for the projects to be really, really ambitious and fighting with the climate challenges that we have. And today I'm talking to Jakob Sandel Sørensen, who is the associate partner at Schønhær, which is one of the most renowned landscape architecture offices here in Denmark, that was created, I think, exactly 40 years ago. And today we will focus on his journey for landscape architecture. And I think that this is also extremely important to mention that in this series, I would like to cover the lens of the architecture profession. So I will be asking my guest on how did they start being a landscape architect, and how should all the young people, all the ones of you who are maybe studying landscape architecture or are freshly graduated, how can you leverage your approach to landing a good job, and how can you be the change makers in the industry, and also how to break in into the landscape architecture, which is quite a competitive profession in the industry. So that's what the landscape series is about, and I will be hopefully hosting many more inspiring landscape architects, so please stay tuned for our other episodes. And today, let me invite you to the first one of the series together with Jakob, where we explore all different things about landscape architecture. I think that was a very inspiring conversation, and I hope that you will enjoy listening to that too. Yeah, I think that we already had a good start to this discussion, because we started discussing a topic that is very relevant to our discussion today. But before we dive into that, I would like to say, Jakob, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining our podcast on this journey of mine, which is discovering landscape architecture, especially through the lens of renowned experts from Copenhagen within landscape architecture. And I think that Schønhær, if I pronounce it correctly. I know Danish now, but it's still a challenge sometimes, of course. I think that Schønhær is definitely one of the companies that is on the horizon if you discuss landscape architecture. So this landscape series that I started, it is about discussing those approaches to landscape architecture, but also giving some guidance to the younger folks. I have a lot of listeners that are studying or maybe after studies and are looking for some jobs, internships. And as you said, maybe also painting a picture of your own kind of career development. You just said that it is very important, before we start recording, have internships, get your face out there, and even do some maybe unpaid internships, which might be a bit controversial. But how it was in your case? So how did you break into the industry?
Well, actually, in my case, it was a bit different. I had no plans of becoming a landscape architect at all. No one in my family works in architecture or landscape architecture, so I'm the first one. And I actually wanted to be an attorney or a psychologist.
Not that close.
And my third option was landscape architecture. Because I thought it kind of sounded nice. It was presented as a profession where it's a combination of desk work, but you also get to get your hands dirty, to work with nature, to work with a lot of different interests and a lot of different priorities. I knew nothing about it, but I thought it sounded interestingly. So I applied as my third option for landscape architecture at what was then called the Agricultural College in Copenhagen. Now it's part of the Copenhagen University. And I got in, barely, but I haven't really regretted it since. I think it's a very interesting profession. I think it's a very wide, very varied profession. There are many different things you can focus on and study. So I'm still studying every day. I'm learning as I go. But as I said before we started recording, I think I wish someone had told me when I was studying how important it is to get your foot in the door, perhaps even before you finish your studies. A great deal of the employments that happen in our line of business happen that way. We don't usually apply for people. We know someone who knows someone, and that's the way you get in. But in my case, it was actually a little different. I was running out of tuition, FSU, towards the end of my studies. I had spent a couple of years on business college before starting on landscape architecture. So I was running out of funding, so to speak. And by chance, I got the opportunity to start my own company before I finished my studies. So I actually started as an independent counseling company a year or two before I actually finished my studies.
Was it still within landscape architecture?
Within landscape architecture, yes. Some do that, but I think that's a less traditional way of entering the profession.
That's a brilliant remark, especially because, as I mentioned myself, I also transitioned from urban designer to business development. And I think that this is such a crucial element that one thing is to draw the project, but another thing is to get the project, get your face out there in front of the client and so on. Before we dive into the business side of things, when you discussed the education and when you started at the Agricultural College, did you feel that you were prepared enough for the profession, or that the disconnect was there already?
I think there is a huge difference between studying and working professionally. What you have a chance to do when you're studying is to spend a lot more time on examining things and analyzing things and developing things. When we work professionally, we are always under pressure, time-wise. So we have to deliver. We don't have the luxury of looking at things for 2 or 3 weeks. Sometimes we have a decision to make within a couple of days. So getting used to that, I think, is the biggest barrier. Then, of course, you can't learn everything at school. There are many things you don't know when you start as a professional. So it's still, I have to say, it's a very steep learning curve. But I think you should just go for what your interests are. Try to find a place that works within that field or where you can see yourself contributing positively or having an opportunity to learn from some of the best. I think that's the way you should try to choose. But also, as I said earlier, I think you should try to make yourself relevant already when you're studying. You should try to focus your interests as early as possible.
Well, how could you do that as a student? Because I know some of them graduating and having some projects or master theses often, and nowadays, especially with this green agenda, so turning the very hardscape surfaces, hardscape landscape into the ones with a lot of greenery, with biodiversity and so on. And sometimes maybe they already show the skill and the thinking, but they have it very hard to get into a company because of the lack of the experience maybe. So would you have any recommendation? Where should they start, actually?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure if there is one specific answer to that question. I think, to be honest, I think it's whether you get a job or not, or whether you seem relevant to a specific company or not, is actually quite random. You have to be lucky. You have to be there at exactly the right time. So it's a question of timing.
I don't know if it's good or bad.
No, I'm sorry, but that's how it is, because everything is happening very fast. So as a company, we may think that today we don't need anyone to help us, but things might look differently tomorrow or in a week from now.
Oh my God, this architecture industry.
So it's everything is up and down. It's moving very fast. So I think, again, the thing is to stay relevant, to stay patient, but to keep trying. And just because they said no once doesn't mean they'll say no next time. So, and of course, your portfolio, the way you present yourself is important. But actually, I think just getting your foot in the door, having a chance to talk to people, making a good first impression, that's really important. And don't give up. Just keep at it. It will happen eventually. I think it is a bit hard. And the other way, of course, is to start your own company, as I did. And then you really have to learn the hard way. Then you depend on only yourself. So that's also a struggle. But you learn a lot fast.
But eventually you switched, you found an employment with another company. So how did that go for you? Like, did you say that it was more or less 2 years of your own company?
Yeah, full time, 2 or 3 years. But then we kind of wound it down. I started it with 2 fellow students at the time. And it kind of wound down. I think we had the company for about 5 or 6 years in total. And I was the one, the last one remaining. So I kind of closed it off, finished the remaining jobs. And then we found employment, all of us, in different places. And that took a bit of getting used to, of course, having been used to being your own boss and managing your own time and your own resources. And suddenly you're on someone else's clock. So I guess the social side of it and the organizational side of it took a little getting used to, but a lot of the knowledge that we gained working completely green and completely fresh, we hadn't been spoiled or we didn't have any bad habits to begin with. We just had to learn everything for ourselves. I think that was a huge advantage. But I guess it's not for everyone. If you can't find a place to work, then start something on your own. Start it small and then just keep busy, keep at it. Because it's better to try and to do something, even if it's just a little bit, than to give up or to change lanes completely.
I think it's again down to the connections you can make through, right?
It's all about networking.
Either competitions or some smaller jobs.
And but I guess that would also be a recommendation that even when you're still a student, there are networks that are open also to students or non-professionals or people getting into the profession. You should definitely participate in that. You should go to conferences. You should go to whatever is happening near you in your city. If nothing else, then just to get the chance to talk to someone who's already in the profession and be seen.
As I mentioned, I have contact with some of the younger landscape designers as well, and I've seen some works of theirs, master theses and so on, and it is pretty impressive. I think they are more and more forward thinking. So let's talk about the sustainability part in landscape, because you are also expert within that field. From what I know, you primarily work with making sure that sustainability is the part of the landscape design here at Schoenherr. Is there a place for sustainability, and can it be that sustainability is also making sense from the financial standpoint? So how hard it is to pitch sustainability nowadays, or is it already so established that it's nothing we should anymore discuss?
Good question. I think in some ways it is already an established idea and an established way of working. But in other ways, it's not at all. In other ways, it's still very much developing and very much in its early stages. I would like to get to a point where sustainability is not a specialty. It's not something that is a particular expertise. It's just something we do as part of what we do and how we do it. But there is a ways to go yet before we get there. So I would think one important aspect of that is being able to provide the proof that sustainability creates value, just as we need to provide proof that everything else we do as architects and landscape architects has value. And nowadays that translates into data. That is hard evidence. That's the scientific way of proving yourself. That's what's in fashion right now. We are, quite frankly, in our profession, not used to having to prove ourselves that way. Earlier, it used to be enough to just say that we were the experts, and people believed it. Of course, we need an architect if we are to design a house, and of course, we need an urban planner if we want to build a new city somewhere. That was self-evident earlier. And now, more and more people require evidence in the shape of data or evidence-based proof that what we say is true. And that's not something that we are used to in our line of work. Tools are developed and being developed rapidly, and all of us are scrambling to analyze our own projects and our own experiences in order to provide that data and to systematically generate that proof. So that's part of the maturing, I think, of the sustainability aspect of the profession, that we need to be better at delivering proof, and in many different ways. So it's not just measuring financial or economic value, it's measuring value much more broadly.
What are some of those measures in your office in Schoenherr and also in landscape architecture? Because I think it's, in a way, it's just easier to discuss a building. You can discuss the energy performance and the facades and all different things like square meters and the performance of the materials. Are they bio-based or not? How would you translate those, the data and all the features of the projects and the numbers especially, to something which is, in my opinion, more complex when we discuss the landscape, which is maybe sometimes less defined?
It is in many ways different when we work as landscape architects. We work with public space. We work with contexts that sometimes much more complicated than within a building. And I agree that to some extent it's easier to measure the effects of a building. The truth is we don't really know yet. We have some tools that kind of mimic what we've done on the building side. So we have some tools that are beginning to enable us to measure the environmental impact of construction projects. So measuring on the material footprint and life cycle assessment tools, for instance. Tools measuring biodiversity creation or biodiversity impacts are also being developed. But I think what we lack, and probably also what building architects and urban planners still lack, is measuring the social effects of what we do. So I think we have something to learn from the social sciences in that sense. So sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists, they have a set of scientific tools and methods that they use. And I think that in many instances, we can apply those tools and should learn to apply those tools on our projects as well.
What would be your dream team for a project, for a successful project? A landscape project, public space project?
There's no specific answer to that, because it, as I said earlier, it's complex and it is completely project specific. But in general, I would say as broad and as varied a team as possible. So as many interests and professions represented as possible, that gives you the best possibility for success. And I think that's also maybe a key difference from landscape architecture or landscape architects to architects, is we are always working in a larger context. We are always working with trying to connect something new to something that is already there. So we have a new piece of a puzzle, but the puzzle is already there. How do we make that piece connect and fit to its existing surroundings in the best possible way? That means that we have to deal with a lot of different interests. It's not just the new building owners or new building users. It's not just the ones who can see your house or have to relate to the facade or the shade that or your building is creating or something like that. Our context is larger and it's more complex. But that means that we are used to working with trying to connect all these different interests, trying to understand them and trying to find the best possible compromise. And that, I think that's a key difference. But that's also a force that we have as landscape architects, that quality that we are in some ways experts, but what we're actually experts in is being generalists and trying to understand and incorporate a lot of different views and interests.
If it comes to that, have you developed, and also back to the sustainability discussion we had, do you have any specific way of working or any tool that you are proud of that you implemented over the years as a company or you personally, that also helped you with this approach?
It's developing as we speak. But yes, of course, I realized maybe 10 years ago that sustainability in the construction industry was still a relatively new term back then, at least to the broad agenda. And I realized that some of the projects I'd done in the past and the way that I had worked on them could actually be fitted under the headline of sustainability. It kind of made sense. It was a new kind of language, you might say, a new explanation for me. So that's when I really started diving into what does sustainability actually mean in an architectural or construction context. I've been working on developing a set of tools or a set of guidelines, a set of discussion points, you might say, rules of thumb that I use in every project and in every context, and that I'm trying to develop and teach my colleagues to use as well. But basically, I think it's about what's actually the problem right now is much bigger than architecture and the construction business. We are facing global scale problems, which are the direct result of how we humans live our lives, particularly in our part of the world. We have a massively too large effect on the rest of the natural world, and we need to bring that footprint down. I think actually this Saturday will be what's known as Earth Overshoot Day or Overshoot Day for Denmark.
Already, wasn't it?
So I think it's the 16th of March this year is the calculation. So
and this is not good. Can you just maybe briefly explain
I'll try to explain what that means. And it's kind of paradoxical because in Denmark, we like to think of ourselves as a very sustainable and green and progressive nation in that sense. But in reality, if you really calculate everything that goes into our footprint and environmental impact, Denmark is one of the most polluting countries, one of the most overspending countries in the world. From Saturday and the rest of the year, we'll be on overdraft. We have used our part of the planetary budget, you might say. If you take the planet's biocapacity and divide it, yearly capacity, and divide it equally among everyone in the world, every human in the world, then we have used our part of that budget already.
For Denmark.
For Denmark, already by mid-March. So that's massively unsustainable as it is.
Do you remember when it was last year?
The 18th or 20th of March, but it's going the wrong direction.
It's going the wrong way, exactly.
Still. So I think as far as I remember, on average, we would need about 1.7, 1.75 biospheres or Earths per year to sustain the average lifestyle that we have globally right now. But in Denmark, that number is more than 4.8 Earths. So we're using more than almost five times our budget. So back to how I like to work with it, that means and the architecture business or the construction business as a whole has a great responsibility because we're responsible for 30 to 40% of emissions and pollution and the use of virgin raw materials and so on. So we have to do something. We have to do our part. In order to make that happen, to make that truly circular, it's a very large systemic, global systemic change that we need to get to. That's going to take some time. And until we get there, the only thing we can do is build much less. So reduce our footprint as fast as possible. So my first rule of thumb is how much do we actually need to do? How little can we settle for, actually? If you get a project, if you get an assignment, you have a project site, you have to analyze that site very carefully. You have to look at what's already there. If you can leave it exactly as it is, that's option number one. Change as little as possible. Then, of course, the second option is recycle or reuse as much of what is already there on site, if possible, through refurbishment or rearrangement. But try to minimize the amount of new virgin raw material that you need to put into the project and of energy that you need in order to transport these materials to and from the site. That's also a difference between buildings and between landscape or construction projects, infrastructure projects. If you look at an LCA, life cycle assessment of a building, you will see that a significant part of the footprint lies in the early stages, in the materials that you use in your design. They've already had an impact somewhere else. They've been mined, they've been dug up, they've been transported to a facility, they've been processed and turned into a building materials. That's the kind of initial footprint, you might say. That's absolutely significant when you look at a building. But a building in use also uses a lot of energy. We've become a lot better at minimizing that energy use, but it still uses a lot of energy to heat the building, to cool the building. to run all the electrical appliances and so on. And that's the difference between a building and a landscape project. Because when a landscape project is built, the energy use that you have in the lifetime phase is significantly lower than for a building. So when you look at a typical LCA for a landscape project, the initial impact, the upfront carbon, you might say, part of the total budget is much larger in a landscape project. And that means that if we are to lower our footprint as landscape architects, we need to look at how we design our projects and how we build them, because it's the upfront footprint that we need to lower.
But you can offset that also later, like, for example, with the vegetation and, you know, trees and so on.
Yes, you can, but we need reductions now. We can't wait 30 or 50 or 80 years for an offset. And no matter how many trees we plant, it's still not going to be enough. We have to reduce our level of activity in general. That's what I'm working with. That's the center of focus, you might say, in terms of sustainability and what we're working with. And then we're trying to get that into every project somehow. It's not dogmatic. We're not working with a specific set of rules or skills every time and a fixed goal that we need to achieve every time. We look at projects quite pragmatically and think, what is achievable in this context, in this place, in this timeline, in this economy, in this group of people? What can we do? What makes sense to everybody? And where do we need to put our focus?
To use an example of your work to explain that even further, my favorite project is Karensminde's Plads in Sydhavn district in Copenhagen. We could also mention, if you think it's relevant, the Copenhagen Islands project that you also presented at the Biennale in Venice last year. How would you apply those measures? Yeah, on the example of your project. So for example, in Karensminde's, I will also add the link to the description for those of you who don't know the project. It is some sort of this linear park between the rows of long buildings. And in that case, as far as I remember, there was some greenery there already. It was some sort of a park. And then now there's also some pavement, some bricks, and some wooden deck around. And I really like this project. I really like running there. The nature is still there. But yeah, how sustainable is that? Because I think that there is less greenery than it used to be. And the materials that were put on the site, were they recycled? Where are they coming from? So if you could explain more about this project, because I'm curious.
I don't think anybody has done an LCA on that project, but I think if we were to do an LCA on that project, we would see quite a significant initial footprint in the materials themselves. Because as you say, the clay brick pavers, they are quite energy intensive. They're all new and there's quite a lot of them, and they are quite energy intensive, the production of clay pavers. That particular project, it's quite recently, was inaugurated last year, in the early summer last year. It's part of a large group of projects that municipality in Copenhagen are developing now as a comprehensive plan to adapt the city to climate change, in particular to more rain. So much more precipitation, much more water, and water on the surface of the city than we've been used to earlier.
Especially after the big flood in
2011. And it started with a big rain event in 2011, which was a rude wake-up call. And it caused a lot of damage to property and other things in the city. Then the municipality started developing this comprehensive plan, and then it happened a year or two later again. And then everybody realized that this is actually a problem that we have to really be serious about and do something about. So now there's a plan of, I think it's about 300 projects of different scales put into place and underway. And Karensminde-aksen is one of the recent and larger projects in that plan. As you say, it was an existing park in Sydhavn area in Copenhagen, a park which was quite popular and used by local residents. It basically consisted of a grass strip and a lot of existing fully grown trees on that lawn. It was used for ordinary recreational purposes, walking your dog. There was a small playground. Just next to the park was the local community house, Kulturhus Karensminde, which is a library and a cultural center for that local area. It was a very strong starting point, you might say, for a new project or a development area. But because it had that space in someone's eyes, an unused space or a space, a potential space to store some water or to retain or delay some of the rainwater floods. It was appointed as a project site. And the way we solved the problem of storing, I can't remember the number, but it's quite large quantities of rainwater potentially, is by introducing almost like a river, a path, a kind of a lowered footpath using yellow clay brick pavers. So like a yellow river bed flowing through this park. The way it kind of meanders or flows through that park is to a very large degree defined by the existing trees, by trying to retain and preserve as many of them as possible. So that's why it kind of flows as it does. Then at the side of the park, we added small walls, like seating height walls. And that's actually the top level of the water retention system. So the park can be completely flooded. But in terms of sustainability, I would say, if you calculate the LCA or the footprint, then it's arguably not very sustainable.
But you can argue that it is in another way.
In other ways, yes, we managed to preserve a lot of the existing qualities. We managed, I think, quite successfully to enhance the recreational experience of the place and the quality of the place as a local meeting ground. We, through the introduction of water or more water than what was present in the place earlier, we also added the possibility for a higher variation of planting and biodiversity in general. Water creates life. Water is one of the building stones for life. You need water, you need sunlight, and you need a good soil.
Oxygen, maybe.
And oxygen, but actually, no, plants don't need oxygen. They need the CO2.
Yeah.
That's the great quality
for plants,
of plants.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Then they turn that into oxygen. So in some ways, yes, it can be described as sustainable, but in other ways, absolutely not. And that's, I guess, that's the compromise that you have to accept in any project.
But it's good that you are honest and you're aware of that. And I don't need to like criticize that, but you are already saying that it might have not been the most sustainable project on some of the parts. Jakub, I think there is one more topic for today that I wanted to discuss, which is the overall ambition of the clients you work with. I guess, from what I know, it's a mixture of public and private clients. By public clients, we can mean the municipality of Copenhagen or any other municipality in Denmark, and not only. And private clients, it might be, just private companies, landowners, and so on that want to develop a land. I've already mentioned in the beginning that I know ambitious architects, landscape architects, they are ambitious, maybe sometimes even too ambitious, especially after graduating and having this kind of dreamy workshop at school when you have unlimited funds and you can whatever you want. But yes, let's discuss about the clients, because at the end, they are the ones developing the projects and making them happen. They're having the funds and the agenda. How ambitious would you say are the clients you work with? So in other words, how much do you need to convince the clients to do certain measures that align with your work, your ambition, your visions, and how much it is actually the clients coming to you because they know the ambition?
In general, I would say every client is ambitious, but in their own way. So it varies, of course. And in general, I would also say we always try to push that ambition. We always try to raise that level of ambition. But it really differs from client to client and from project to project. In a way, I guess we're privileged because we are fairly well known. And that means that we get to work with fairly ambitious clients and clients perhaps and projects on a larger scale, and perhaps also clients who have the funds, the backing to pursue that ambition. But really, I would say any client is ambitious. It's just a matter of understanding that ambition and translating that into something, perhaps something a little more and a little more ambitious than they initially thought that they could buy with the money they had or the time they had. And that development, I think, happens through conversation, actually listening to what they need and trying to understand that and creating the best possible translation of that, best possible value for time and money, I would say. It's actually a quite humble approach, I think, is the best way forward. I think if you look at our projects, it's also not easy to see a particular style or a particular shape. That very much comes from understanding each project as a different setting or a different premise and working within that different situation and creating the best of it. That's the forces of our approach as an office is we try to listen to what the client needs, and we try to, of course, we try to push the boundaries a little bit. We try to challenge it. Everybody wants to do better if they possibly can. We try to create a solution that answers their needs as best as possible. We also always try to go for simplicity if we can. So kind of reductionist approach. We never try to over-program a space. We never try to load it with a lot of different materials or a lot of different shapes. We always try to kind of reduce that to its simplest and strongest shape and expression. I think that's a recipe for appreciation over time. More people will see themselves or be able to identify a space as a place of quality if they can understand it, if it makes sense, if it seems logical to them. If it's too complex or if it's too mysterious, if it's too demanding, you might say, then I think it may appeal to some people, but it won't appeal to most people. If I were to define the DNA of what we try to do is we try to approach every project as a new situation. Of course, we have a toolbox that we apply, and then we try to simplify it as much as we possibly can.
We start with a recommendation, especially to younger designers, and let's finish with one as well. So at the end, I would like to ask you for a book recommendation, ideally something around the topic about landscape architecture.
I think I'm going to break the mold there a little bit and say that I think it's actually quite important to study outside of your own box. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would say that as a landscape architect. Personally, I almost never read fiction. I'm boring in that way. But I try to read more or less scientifically based books or research, but usually outside my own area of expertise. So I try to understand how the world works, but from a lot of different perspectives. And usually I find that I can always use some of it in my own work, or it broadens my experience and my understanding of how other people think. And I think that's key to creating good architecture also, is understanding the complexity of the world. So I would recommend, I think it's actually quite an old book by now, but one of the first books I read that tried to explain the value of nature and the value of what nature can do and does for us every day, even though we don't notice it maybe, or put it into dollars and cents. It's a book called What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? I think it's about 10 years old now.
Right.
It's written by a British guy. I think he's a zoologist. He's called Tony Juniper. He's worked in nature conservation, I think, most of his life. I would recommend that book if you can find it. But otherwise, I would look a more recent book called Donut Economics. Maybe you've heard of it. It's by a British economist, Kate Raworth. And that book tries to outline a different kind of economy. Not a growth-based system, but more of a balanced and thriving system. So a system that kind of tries to stay within planetary capacity and boundaries, but still delivers a reasonable level of comfort and pleasure for humans.
I think both of them are recommendations, especially the second one summarizes what we've discussed today. So thank you for that. And overall, Jakub, I wanted to say thank you for taking part and joining me here at Urbcast Landscape Series. I really appreciate it, and I hope that it will be a big learning to the people listening. Thanks.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that was the first episode of the Landscape Series in Urbcast. I think that Jakub shared extremely interesting perspective on the business side of landscape architecture, and not only discuss the planetary boundaries and many other things. You will find the relevant links in the episode description. And I will talk to you soon with another landscape architect, but I will not disclose who will it be. So stay tuned. Thanks.